This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. This week, we travel to Prague to sit down with some travel thought leaders to talk about over-tourism, sustainability, and global impact. Starting with Marino Giannopoulos from Enterprise Greece on over-tourism in a country where a staggering 30% of its GDP is driven by travel and tourism. Then, Ufri Ibrahim, the CEO of the Energy and Environment Alliance, on the true definition of greenwashing. And travel and economics guru Daniel Thornley with a global travel update on the crazy numbers of travel. First up, Marino Giannopoulos.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Every day, our world gets a little more connected, but a little further apart. But then, there are moments that remind us to be more human.
Thank you for calling Amica Insurance.
Hey, I was just in an accident.
Don't worry, we'll get you taken care of.
At Amica, we understand that looking out for each other isn't new or groundbreaking. It's human. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
Marino Giannopoulos, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks. It's an honor and pleasure to have you here, Peter. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for the lovely talk we're going to have.
Well, here's my question, because your job mandate really is to promote investment, to promote visitation, to grow the economy. And with so much of the Greece economy and that GDP on travel and tourism, I mean, I remember, and this happens every year, I will go to the Grand Britannia Hotel, which, for those people who don't know it, you don't have to stay there. Just go up to the bar if you want the best view in town.
That's right.
And you sit there at the bar, and you look out over the Acropolis. And if you bring binoculars, you can actually see, it looks like ants. It's thousands of people climbing up every day. And of course, this past summer, in incredible heat. You even had to stop it at one point. It was so hot. So I remember your former tourism minister, Elena, telling me the solution to over-tourism is we're just going to ask people to come in October. That doesn't quite work out, does it?
No, it doesn't. First of all, you're quite right. Let me just by saying that Enterprise Greece is the official government agency under the auspices of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Our job essentially is twofold: to promote exports and attract investments in Greece. And of course, tourism and real estate, that's what we're here for, plays a huge role in our part. And of course, as you said, the GDP. It's something like 30% of the GDP of the country that relies
on tourism. Which is huge.
It's huge.
Because the international average is only about 11. So you're way above that.
It is huge. It is huge. And that's why we focus a lot on tourism. And of course, as you said, because many people, especially Americans, grow up with learning about Greece and learning the history from a young age at school, it's amazing to be able to come over and, you know, experience that. And that's what we're trying to achieve, for people to actually be able to go through all the ancient kind of Athens and then experience the new Athens that we're trying to promote as well.
But it's not just Athens, it's everything outside of Athens too.
True. Basically, we have over 2,000 islands that you can visit. The coastline is endless. And of course, along with the mild climate and the Mediterranean diet that we have in Greece, as I'm sure you've experienced, I think it's an amazing combination. But that's not just what we have to offer. We try to offer a product, as you said, like seasonality is over. We're trying to expand the season by different means. We're trying to promote other means of tourism, like wellness and going skiing. You know, you can have skiing in Greece, even though it's for some people it seems weird. But we have snow.
Well, you know, we did a one-hour special on Turkey, and we spent some time at a ski resort like nobody knew.
Exactly. But that being said, I think as you mentioned, Athens has been booming. I think we had the last 4 years over than 60 new hotels that appeared in Athens. And I think that adds to the effect that you said, like the ants crawling up the hills of Philopappou and Acropolis. So much that actually they have announced that they're going to have a cap of 20,000 visitors per day. That's the cap. That's the cap.
20,000 alone sounds pretty astounding.
It is, but I think it's an experience. You know, once you're there, if it's not too hot, because it can get too hot, it's something, you know, that it's amazing to be there.
It's sort of a double-edged sword. You want development on one hand,
and
you have to manage your numbers on the other. And you know, I'm one of those people, I believe, even though seasonality, everybody tells me it's going, I believe in the off-season. I don't mind going to Athens in November. I don't mind going in February. In fact, that's when I want to go to Venice. I don't want to go in June, July, or August. So if people can be smart in terms of their plans, you have to ask yourself, am I going to Paris to get a suntan? No, I'll go in November, right? Why am I going to Greece? Well, you want to immerse yourself in the culture, you want to learn about the history. You can do that even if it's raining. I mean, for me, that's the reason why you're going.
Definitely, and you're quite right. This is something that we're, along with the city of Athens, we're trying to promote as well. It's an all year round destination. You've got a conference destination. We have lots of conference happening in Greece, lots of new development along with parks. And of course, we have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, redevelopment in Europe right now, Ellinikon, which is an 8 billion redevelopment project. Just to give you the numbers, it's going to add another 40% of green area in Athens. It's huge. It's the old airport where it used to be, where they moved to the new airport.
And you need that.
And we definitely need that. And it's something that's going to add to the city's, you know, not just skyline, but with new hotels, new parks, new recreation areas.
So let's talk about those other 2,000 islands. You know, you land in Athens. What I like to do is I land in Athens. I try to bookend it, right? Land in Athens, spend 3 days, and then get out and visit someplace you've never been. One of my favorite islands is an island that hasn't been getting a lot of traction, is Milos. And in fact, it's a fishing village. And in fact, they used to fish with the old kerosene lamps and catch the fish that way. It's a beautiful place to go. And by the same token, and with all due respect, Santorini, you're elbow to elbow. You can't move. So there's an opportunity here to look at the other islands.
Definitely, and it's something that we have taken notice as well, and that's why this kind of planning on development of different islands, of course, Santorini and Mykonos are top list how they're starting to reduce development and see kind of the future, because all the development happened once, so all people flocked together.
It definitely did.
But there's so many, as you mentioned, there's so many other islands that are amazing to visit and see. Milos is one of them, with amazing, spectacular beaches that you can view. I think the best part of everything is you can get a boat and do island hopping. I think that's one of the
Well, you have a
best.
Very good ferry system.
Yes.
I mean, let's talk about that, because you can do great day trips or even 1.5 day trips. It's not expensive to take the ferry. It's kind of a fun way to do it. You don't always have to fly.
Exactly. No, you're quite right. Just to start to begin with, you're half an hour from the center of Athens to an amazing beach in Athens where you can be swimming. But then again, you can take the ferry and visit the really like close proximity to Athens Islands, which is half an hour away, either Aspetes and Salamina and Aegina. But then again, within two hours...
Say those islands again, which
it's,
one?
It's Salamina, Aegina, Indra and Spetses, which I definitely urge you to visit next time you're there. Idra, for example, is an island with no cars. You just go, and it's like a beautiful, spectacular old
town. That's my kind of island.
But then again, within 2 hours, you are close to Milos, Mykonos, all the other islands that in the Cycladic system of islands. But I think the way because we're investing in infrastructure as well, so we're trying to expand ports, to expand kind of the experience for the tourists as well. So you get the ferry. It's not kind of what other listeners may remember, like 20 years ago, that you go, there's like people with the signs and everything, stay here. But now it's a more organized system with, you know, transport and everything. So I think it makes the experience much better than what it used to be. And I'd just like to mention this point, the island of Astypalea, which is the first island, I don't know if you know about
that. Say that the name again?
Astypalea. It's the first green island, let's say, where basically everything is run on solar power and renewable energy. There's no petrol. All the cars are electric. Even the buses, you just click a button and the bus will come and pick you up and take you around the island. It's something, it's in cooperation with Volkswagen, and it's the first of its kind. It's definitely something that's worth a visit.
Wow. A totally green island.
Totally green island.
Now, of course, then there's the issue of cruise ships.
Yeah.
We're looking now at the cruise industry being much more responsible in terms of their scheduling. I mean, I can think of nothing less attractive than to go to the island of St. Martin or St. Thomas and have 7 cruise ships there at the same time. There are not even enough bathrooms there. I mean, it's crazy. So they're now working. Some people aren't, but a lot of destinations are now saying, we're going to limit the number of cruise ships that can be in our port on any one day so that people can truly experience it in a great way. It's just a matter of rescheduling the ships.
You're quite right. And that's what it should be. Like, you have a proper schedule of who comes and who goes. But it starts with having the infrastructure in place. I think the Port of Piraeus has, like, a lot of money has gone into expanding the port. Obviously, you've got Costco on the other side as a huge logistics hub. So you're trying to separate the two and have everything in place. But I think having Athens with Thessaloniki as well, which now is seeing more than 60 cruise ships that go to Thessaloniki, something that someone should experience as well. We're trying to limit, as you said, the number of people while maximizing their potential of enjoying Greece and actually seeing other places as well.
I always like to say, if I'm going to fly somewhere, I always ask, what days are the cruise ships not here? That's where I want to be. That's where I want to go walking. And you know what? It's very easy to find out that information. And if you're going to be on a cruise ship, you should ask before you ever book the cruise, when you get to this port, how many other ships are going to be there? Maybe I don't want to take that particular itinerary simply because I want to be able to enjoy the experience as a passenger as well.
Definitely, of course. And I think apart from just cruise ship, I think it's worth for anyone going to the Ministry of Tourism website and seeing, because they're actually doing lots of information of like winery visits or following spring around. For example, if you want to come at different, because as we said before, it's a mild climate. So if you come in spring, you still got the sun, but then you got all the nice flower boomings and you can actually follow spring around. There's like an actual route. So I think in combination with that, it's information you can find really easily.
My thanks to Marino. So, okay, which hotels and chains are acting responsibly when it comes to real sustainability? And how do you as a traveler know? And then, what can you do about it? Ufa Ibrahim not only tracks hotel behavior, but holds these folks accountable.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Please welcome Ufi Ibrahim. Ufi, let's get down to a definition of terms. I've talked about this on the show before. We've had other guests speaking about it. But I think we need to really get down to a real definition now. You know, I go back to the days where you'd go to a hotel and there'd be a little sign at your bed saying, hey, help us save the environment by not washing your towel tonight, right? I always used to laugh because the sign was in plastic. I thought they sort of missed the point. But that sort of started that word coming out called greenwashing.
That's right, yes. And the term greenwashing was actually coined in a hotel bathroom in 1986 by an environmentalist called Jay Vesterveld.
By the way, a lot of things get coined in hotel bathrooms, but that's another story. Go ahead.
Probably, if not in hotel bedrooms.
Yes.
But the term and the way that Jay Vesterveld actually defined it is what today equals the official definition of greenwashing, which is if you are unable to substantiate your environmental claims with robust evidence, then in effect you are greenwashing.
And so taking that definition and doing the work that you're doing, how do you bring everybody into the tent and explain to them a definition that they can actually live with and live by?
Well, interestingly, and thankfully, regulators are actually helping us to do that, to get everybody into one room to figure out not what needs to be done, but how it needs to be done. That's the important part. So there's a lot of things that many are already doing, but the question is, how are they going about it? It's about bringing quality into the system.
Now, of course, you know, I get inundated with press releases all the time saying, guess what? We're no longer using single-use plastics. We got rid of the straws. That's all good.
All good.
But not enough.
Not enough. Absolutely not enough at all. We're talking about transforming every aspect, every decision made in business.
So give me an example, because at the end of the day, let's face it, it is a business. They have to make a profit. If they're worried about the cost of performing or doing the right thing, sometimes they just don't.
Yep. Well, take energy use, for example. You know, there's been a lot of emphasis recently on carbon because of climate change, and this is the area where regulators are really putting the emphasis. So at the moment, you know, we are, and in terms of commercial buildings, hotels are the commercial building type that uses more energy than any other type of commercial building. And we use more water than any other type of commercial building.
Well, because it's 24/7.
And we create more waste than any other type of commercial building. Now, one thing is to say, okay, let's educate the guests. Let's ask them to use less electricity or gas. Let's ask them to use less water.
But they don't.
But actually, something interesting happened, Peter. During COVID, when hotels were under lockdown, we found that something like 60% of the total energy use in a hotel has nothing to do with the guests.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, yes, it's good to ask the guests, but if you really want to do something substantial about addressing the amount of carbon that you are producing as a building, then it's not enough to simply ask your guests to change their behavior when they're on site. You actually have to look at the building and you have to look at how you are operating that building. And that's the reality. So when you look at the data, it becomes clear as to where the responsibility truly lies.
But that really speaks to the need for a complete redesign of hotels in a certain way.
And which would be wonderful. If we could redesign and rebuild, it would be great. But the reality is that when we get to 2050, 80% of the buildings that we'll have then are already here. And retrofitting and refurbishing existing buildings is difficult and it's expensive, especially if you consider that many hotels are very old buildings. Some are monuments. So actually transitioning them to be net zero, that is challenging.
They're protected historic buildings.
Protected, listed buildings. So it becomes very complex and you have to work with a lot of partners to make that possible.
So let's go back to that 60% figure you gave me that's being done with or without guests.
Correct, yeah.
What's the worst offending aspect of it?
Building management systems. You know, they are the single system within a building. Sometimes they have big flashing lights. People don't understand how to use them. The engineer that installed them has moved on. And it's just down there guzzling up huge amounts of energy.
People go online and make hotel reservations. There's not a box they can tick when they make a reservation saying, are you doing the right thing? There's no box that they can read that says, oh, by the way, 50% of our energy has been fixed already. I mean, so what do you need to ask? It gets down to having a conversation, and you're not going to have that online anyway. So I'm a big fan, as you may know, of having a conversation, of getting on the phone and talking to somebody before you book an airline ticket, a hotel room, a cruise. So what questions do you need to ask without being adversarial? But just to learn before you make that decision to book something.
Well, it's interesting because when you look at data of, you know, surveys done by Expedia, Booking.com, you know, all of those sorts of Google and others, all of their customer base, 80%, 90%, you know, 70%+ say that they want to stay in a sustainable hotel and that going forward, they really want to make sure any travel decision is based on the sustainable footprint of that decision.
But you know what? That's like the hotel guest filling out a questionnaire saying, I'll only stay at a hotel if they have a swimming pool, or I'll only stay at a hotel if they have a health club, and only 8% of the guests use it. So which is it?
Well, but there's something called the say-do gap at the moment. So while consumers are actually saying that they want this, they are not making transactional decisions on this basis. So if you look at the number of guests who are actually potential guests using the sustainability filter on these big booking engines, they're very, very small. They're less than 10% of transactions today. Now, the question is from some investors and people who actually run hotels, well, do guests really care? And I believe that, yes, guests do really care because they're telling us they care. But the question is, how can they tell? If you are really doing this or if you're greenwashing.
Right. So, okay.
And that's what we have to address as an industry. We have to make sure that we can evidence and substantiate that in a robust way so that consumers can have confidence.
I remember going to a Fairmont hotel in Arizona and they were telling me, and you have to applaud this, they figured out a way not to throw cooking oil down the drain. They figured out a way to reuse the cooking oil as biofuel. And, you know, and we're talking about the French fries, right? And once a week a truck will come and they will load it up with all that oil. And it has another use, and it's not going into the systems where it just does harm. And I said, have you told your guests? Oh, they don't want to know that. Actually, I think they do. You know, you ask kids where food comes from, they tell you the store. I got a problem with that. I really believe, and I think you do too, that if you can understand and appreciate the process, that's when you value the product. So as you come up with all the things that are needed, that basically fit a definition of responsible stewardship of your resources and ESG, how do you communicate that to the guest? That's the key.
Absolutely. Storytelling is something that we're going to have to reinvent. We're going to have to reinvent and design the design of the buildings. We're going to have to reinvent the controls, the processes, the way we do things, the way we measure things, and the way we communicate things.
So when you check into a hotel room, Ufi, what do you look for?
I look for evidence that hotel is actually doing what it says it's doing on the tin.
For example?
So, for example, I tend to look and see what type of accreditations the building has, what type of, certifications it may have. But even those I have to take with a pinch of salt because, you know, even very well-known certification programs actually are mainly checkbox exercises. And that's just not good enough. So it is a bit of a detective work. And I have to say, you know, customers cannot be expected to do that detective work, which is why I think it's absolutely right that businesses do this for themselves and that legislators are actually going to push businesses to do it in the right way.
See, when I check into a room, and this goes back to pre-pandemic days, I used to get angry when I saw all these tent cards and paper and promotional items and stuff. The first thing I did was I put it in the desk drawer. I didn't want to see it. But what a waste of resources, right? We've talked about single-use plastics and plastic straws. I was then made aware of the volume of that, which was pretty staggering. But then again, you got to also figure out what's the stuff that's back of the house that you don't see.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And, you know, it reminds me of the case of electric cars, electric vehicles. You know, there's a lot of people that feel very virtuous when they drive an electric vehicle. And it's great because, you know, it's having a good impact ultimately in the long term on addressing climate change. But it's not acceptable if the core materials that have been used to create those electric car batteries have actually been mined by children in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's not acceptable. So it's just not enough to look at the what's on the surface. You have to actually, I mean, it's up to the businesses, I think, to be truly responsible and to put real stewardship to ensure that they look at the value chain employees. We're talking really now about, okay, what's going to happen with Scope 3? Because one thing is to say, okay, this is what I'm doing under this roof, but then what about everything that you are impacting, all the decisions that you're making, your purchasing decisions, who you're doing business with, all of that needs to be addressed.
And all questions that if you want to be a responsible traveler, it's okay to ask.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. In fact, I would urge every traveler to question, quiz the hotelier that they're going to, you know, stay with, pick up the phone, call them and say, tell me about your sustainability policy. And if the receptionist can't do it, then that's already a very poor mark that hotel should have.
My thanks to Ufi. Revenge travel, outrageous prices, full planes. Can it continue? And if so, for how long? Dr. Daniel Thornerly has more than a few fact-based predictions. Dr. Daniel Thornerly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So every time I listen to you, there's a little bit of doom and gloom, but then again, there's some light at the end of the tunnel. We're looking at a situation where travelers come raging back, that much we know. We know that hotel rates are at near historic highs. Airline fares are at near historic highs. This summer, Americans invaded Europe. There were hardly hotel rooms you could find, and if you did, they started at about $1,200 a night. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. I guess the first question I have to ask you is, given the nature of the disruptive aspects of the world, which have not left us at all, in fact, they've gotten worse in some cases, is this sustainable?
We are certainly seeing the boom that you talk about, Peter, in hospitality, airlines, and so forth. I think one, to answer the question directly, and you would know about it as well, is what are the Chinese tourists going to do?
Because they've been quiet for a while because they had to be, right? That wave has not come back yet.
Exactly. Will it come back in its entirety? Will it come back in dribs and drabs? I don't know. I think it's at the moment dribs and drabs. The Chinese economy, of course, is not booming as it used to. But to your point, if and when the Chinese decide to come back en masse, then given what we've already got, that would raise questions about sustainability and capacity and so forth, both in hotels and in transportation. And then price might be another defining factor is, you know, price them out of the market if you can. I can't see the operators doing that. They would put more planes in the air. Hotel capacity would increase one way or the other. And a last quick point, which we talked about today at the event, is I think premium and luxury hospitality are doing well, as they are in many other product sectors.
And the economy aspects are doing well.
Yes. I'll come back to that if we have. I think so too. But on the hospitality, you've got premium, super premium, luxury doing well. But at the other end of the scale, discount, cheap, promo, own label. But in hospitality, because as you said, it's so good, I think the mid-range and mid-brand, which usually struggles, is doing well.
See, that's a surprise to me. I'll tell you why. Because if you can define your brand, you can justify your rates. So I know what a luxury brand is. They've done a pretty good job of defining what they are, what they're doing, what they offer. I have a pretty good idea what the economy brands are doing, right? What they're offering, what I value, right? It's the mid-level brands that have always been the confusing aspect of it. And I'll ask you this rhetorical question. And I'm not singling out any one particular brand, but I'll just use it as an example. I mean, if somebody says to me, you're staying at a St. Regis or a Ritz-Carlton or a Mandarin or Four Seasons, I respond differently to that. Obviously, I'm happier about that. I'm looking forward to it. I have different expectations. If somebody says I'm staying at a Hampton's Inn, I'm going, oh, great, I get breakfast. You know, and I understand what that offering is. But when somebody says to me I'm staying at a Sheraton or a Hilton or just a regular Marriott, there's no real emotional connection for me, other than maybe their frequent stay program, which is another issue. But what's going to get me to go into the middle when I have two choices that are so well-defined on either end?
One answer is I don't know, but the second answer is availability. So if the premium and luxury are booked up, and if you fancy not overindulging but semi-indulging, because I think you're right, and that's the problem with the mid-range, mid-price, vacuum cleaners, chocolate, anything, you name it. But if you can't get the sub-premium availability-wise, or the cost is really, as you're implying, you know, zooming upwards, and then you don't want to really go too economy, then I think you will look around for that mid-range, mid-price. And I think price...
But it's not your first choice.
No, it's not. I think people spend hours, as you know, better than me. Some friends of mine were talking about, you know, doing their own travel agency to save time, but they spend hours looking at the best rates and best options. I think price would be the defining issue on that. Price and availability.
Well, price is always, you know, people have told me for years that if an airline raises its fares $5, people will choose another airline. I mean, it's that sensitive in terms of moving the needle. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the same anymore because of availability.
That's right,
and because
yeah.
The airlines have basically priced themselves similarly. It's about the clearest cut case of an antitrust case I can think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see airlines differing in fares at all at the legacy level. And hotels are about the same as what the market will bear in a city. So if your most expensive hotel room is $500 a night in a city, you'll see the luxury hotels at $500 a night. Mm-hmm. They move to that point, right? The airlines don't really differentiate either. So it's if the prices are all the same at the different entry points, then you have to make choices based on something else.
I don't know what it's like in the US, but in Europe on airlines, you know, and I live in Vienna at the center, the availability and choice is limited. You know, Lufthansa have a monopoly, semi-monopoly here on a lot of flights.
Well, Lufthansa owns Lufthansa. They've got Austrian. I think they've got Swiss. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they got it all.
Yeah. And they do the travel transfers to their satisfaction. You used to be able to fly direct to Dubai from Vienna with Austrian Airlines. Now you have to go via Germany for the satisfaction of Lufthansa, not the customer. But there's not much you can do about airlines, I think, whereas with hotels, you know, literally your feet can define where you go to some extent. You know, there's more availability of hotels than there are airlines. But that's a quibble.
Well, you bring up a very interesting point. Your choices of airlines have been exponentially reduced, and your choices of routes have been exponentially reduced. Your choices of fares have been exponentially reduced. So that has to affect even if you can get to the hotel you want to go to in a certain destination.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And that's going to be a continuing problem in terms of hotels that are being built, being developed, because you can't just develop a hotel if you don't have the airlift. If you're dealing with different countries, I'm not talking about hotels where there's a big drive-to market, but I'm talking about if people can't get there or they can't get there affordably, it doesn't matter how you price the hotel, they're not going to come.
Indeed.
So how do you work within that system? How do you work with hotels and airlines to say, guys, can you just figure out there is a cause and effect here? There are financial consequences from one sector of the industry drastically affecting the other.
Was that a question?
Yes, it was.
Right. I tend to think that the companies are driven, as you might agree, by profit and loss. I tend to think that customer satisfaction or customer convenience comes after the cost availability to the companies. And I think the grind and wear and tear on publicly quoted corporations and share price is so vicious that that's the defining feature. That's just my own quirky opinion.
But you're affected by it just like I am. Mm-hmm. Right? So the question then becomes, here we are at a hospitality investment conference. You know, if I'm an investor, I need to know what my landscape is. Not just the physical landscape of where I'm placing the hotel, but how people are going to get there and afford it.
By the way, just a quick story, which I don't think you know. Vienna to Prague is one of the slowest train journeys in the world. Admittedly, it's not in a straight line. It goes in a historical loop. But it takes just over 4 hours to do 250 kilometers. There used to be two airlines flying from Vienna to Prague, a short hop. You went up, you cruised for 5 minutes, and then you came down. There used to be Czech Airlines and Austrian Airlines. Czech Airlines went off that route, and I think even out of business. So you had the monopoly of Austrian and Lufthansa. That route, to my knowledge, became the most expensive airline route in the world. And
on a per mile basis, probably.
Yeah, per kilometer. Basis, exactly, sorry. And it would be, well, you know, 250, 300 kilometers for economy tickets, which went from, originally they'd been a couple of hundred euros, went to 500, 600, 700 euros for a, you know, a 40-minute flight or 35 minutes. So it just shows monopoly, control, pricing. And before that, I used to take the train because I love trains and I don't like planes. Don't like planes. And now I always travel on the slow puff puff going chug 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 to Prague. And I'll be doing that later today going home.
Well, at a reasonable fare, I presume.
Very reasonable.
You know, this is the value proposition I ask everybody. As we see things change so radically, if I need to go from point A to point B and the airfare on one airline is $600, and for that you'll get some mileage, which you can't redeem, and the airfare on a low-fare carrier is $200, for which you don't care about the mileage, why would you pick the other airline unless you were addicted to the mileage program? And I think we've reached a tipping point. This also gets into airlift to get to hotels. I think we've reached a tipping point where people are saying, you know what, I don't think the mileage programs are worth it anymore because I can't redeem my miles, and when I do, they've devalued them so much it doesn't matter.
I think if you're addicted to mileage programs, you're leading a sad life.
Well, you're talking to somebody who was leading a sad life until I woke up.
Good for you.
No, but do you agree with that, right?
I mean, yes, I do indeed. Yeah, my miles are stacking up and I can't figure out how to use them and when to use them. And as you say, the programs change to the benefit of the companies, and they come out with these little emails telling you about how they're going to enhance consumer satisfaction, etc. And wiser heads should know that's a load of baloney.
For which you get no miles. But the point is, that's changing the dynamic of the choices people are making, assuming they can have the choices for airlift. How are the hotels adapting to this? Because you're seeing rampant hotel development again, going back to the days pre-pandemic. You're seeing it in some of the same markets that were developing before. You know, you mentioned the China market earlier in our conversation. One of the biggest areas of development has been China, not because I'm going to fly there and stay at that hotel. It's the Chinese who are going to fly or drive in the regional markets too.
Mm-hmm. I think the hotel industry is, as we said before, the roller coaster, and this time we're on the upward curve, which could last a long time in several parts of the world. I think geopolitics will play a part in it. I'm not sure about the US tourist numbers to China and so forth, but certainly some of the shine of the economy, business, visiting, culture, scholarly work with China, has, some of the shine has come off. And companies and everybody else are looking for alternatives. That could be the CIS markets, India, other parts of Southeast Asia, the Gulf, GCC. Dubai is booming and wants to become the new Switzerland of the new developed world. And, of course, another part which is very appealing is Central Europe.
Speaking of Central Europe, to what extent is the war in Ukraine having an impact on that?
Well, counterintuitively, as I say, maybe 18 months ago, you would have thought that this would have been catastrophic for the region, having a war 130 kilometers away from your borders. It's not had that. It's created an esprit de corps across the region, corporately, societally, culturally, and it's been very strong and powerful. Whether that proves sustainable over another 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because that's how long the war will be, is questionable. I think certainly in Central Europe, there is greater strength of purpose than in Western Europe. I think the Balts, the Poles, the Czechs, to some extent the Slovaks. So they've been able to say to Western Europe, and especially the Germans and French, we told you so. They were aware of where Putin was going and what Russia was going to do. War has changed everything. And I think also what's remarkable is that Central Europe economically, corporately, has done well. By the way, since 2013 to 2023, so it's been a decade, the European Union improved and got stronger in 2013, CE followed, EU funds have been pouring in, maybe less so now with the politics of Poland, Hungary, and we've got some wobbling coming up in the elections in Slovakia. But overall, the business satisfaction of Western companies doing business in Central Europe is extremely high. And by the way, as I mentioned today at the event, price increases, which we've just talked about, price increases globally for all products have been rising. But the good news for the consumer and for the producer is that prices are definitely coming down across the world. That's indisputable. They will continue to come down. They might be a bit sticky still this year, start of next year, but better times are ahead on prices, and then maybe a lead-in on interest rates.
My thanks to Daniel, to Marino, and to Ufi. And my thanks to you for listening to this Ion Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, you can always log on to petergreenberg.com.
The Ion Travel Podcast is produced by Amanda Morris and Anthony Protis Chung. For more content from Peter Greenberg and the Ion Travel team, visit petergreenberg.com. Ion Travel is a production of CBS News Radio.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary and it's not boring. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. I'm going to be your financial coach, someone who brings common sense and an insider's perspective on how to manage your money and your emotions. And I promise we are going to have a little bit of fun along the way. Have a question from retirement to career changes to college funding? Just send us an email at askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
It was the biggest scandal in pop music. The stars of Milli Vanilli, the Grammy-winning multi-platinum R&B phenomenon, were exposed as frauds. But none of this was their idea. So whose idea was it? Enter German music producer Frank Farian. He saw the success of acts like Michael Jackson and Prince, and he wanted in, no matter the cost. So he devised the perfect pop heist. Two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? They couldn't sing. But Frank knew just how to fix that. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies and takes a never-before-heard look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when the truth came out, Rob and Fab were the only ones who got burned. Looking back now, it's hard not to wonder, why did everyone blame them and not the man pulling the strings? Follow Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.